Hello, I'm FNH, and this is the Cthulhu Podcast. This podcast, home on the web, is at cthulhupodcast.co.uk. Welcome to this, the 19th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. Before I get to today's menu, I'd like to let you know that I'm now using a new email address for this podcast. You can contact me by sending emails to cthulhupodcast@gmail.com. Now on to today's menu. The history segment is an overview of the 1927 Mississippi Flood. Then we'll hear a musical track from the 20s called Slave to the Blues by Ma Rainey. Following that, we'll have a very well-produced version of Lovecraft's Memory, a product of the N. Pendleton Studio. Not stopping there, we follow that with a reading of a story called The Thing in the Shadows, an original work submitted by listener Andrew Duncan. So, let's get started. The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927. This flood was the most destructive river flood in the United States history. The flood began when heavy rains pounded the central basin of Mississippi in the summer of 1926. By September, the Mississippi's tributaries in Kansas and Iowa were swollen to capacity. On New Year's Day of 1927, the Cumberland River at Nashville topped levees at 56.2 feet. The Mississippi River broke out of its levee system in 145 places and flooded 27,000 square miles. The area was inundated up to a depth of 30 feet. The flood caused over $400 million in damages and killed, sadly, 246 people across 7 states. The flood affected Arkansas, Illinois, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, and Tennessee. Arkansas was hardest hit, with 14% of its territory covered by floodwaters. By May in 1927, the Mississippi River below Memphis, Tennessee, reached a width of, wait for it, 60 miles. As the flood approached New Orleans, about 30 tons of dynamite was set off on the levee at Carnarvon and sent 250,000 cubic feet of water pouring through. This prevented New Orleans from experiencing serious damage, but did flood much of St. Bernard Parish and all of Plaquemines Parish's east bank. And as it turned out, the destruction of the Carnarvon levee was unnecessary. Several major levee breaks well upstream of New Orleans, including one the day after the demolitions, made it impossible for the floodwaters to seriously threaten the city. By August in 1927, the flood subsided. During the disaster, 700,000 people were displaced, including 330,000 African Americans, who were moved to 154 relief camps. Over 13,000 evacuees near Greenville, Mississippi, were gathered from area farms and evacuated to the crest of an unbroken levee, and then stranded there for days without food or water. Yet during this time, boats were arriving, but were only evacuating white women and children. In fact, many blacks were detained and forced to labor at gunpoint during the flood relief efforts. Several reports on the terrible situation in the refugee camps, including one by the Colored Advisory Commission by Robert Rusin Morton, were kept out of the media at the request of Herbert Hoover, with the promise of further reforms for blacks after the presidential election. The flood had the unlikely effect of contributing to both the election of Herbert Hoover as president and his defeat 4 years later. He was much lauded for his masterful handling of the refugee camps, but later concerns over the treatment of blacks in those camps caused him to make promises to the African-American community, which he later broke, losing the black vote in his re-election campaign. Following the Great Flood of 1927, the Army Corps of Engineers were again charged with taming the Mississippi River. Under the Flood Control Act of 1928, the world's longest system of levees was built. Floodways that diverted excessive flow from the Mississippi River were constructed. An unexpected effect of this flood was how it added to the great migration of African Americans towards northern cities. Previously, the move from rural South to the northern cities had virtually stopped. But as a result of displacement lasting for up to 6 months, millions of Southern blacks moved to the big cities of the North, particularly Chicago. The social effects of this migration is a subject for another episode. I'm going to include a link in the show notes to a short silent movie that was taken at the time by the US Army. It shows some of the relief efforts and even gives us a view of these refugee camps. And now for today's musical segment. I haven't, unfortunately, been able to place the exact year of this track, but it's called Slave to the Blues and is performed by Ma Rainey. Next segment has been produced by the N. Pendleton Studio. It's a rendition of Lovecraft's Memory. So let's get over to the studio.
Memory by Howard Phillips Lovecraft. In the valley of Nis, the accursed waning moon shines thinly, tearing a path for its light with feeble horns through the lethal foliage of a great upas tree. And within the depths of the valley, where the light reaches not, move forms not meant to be beheld. Rank is the herbage on each slope, where evil vines and creeping plants crawl amidst the stones of ruined palaces, twining tightly about broken columns and strange monoliths, and heaving up marble pavements laid by forgotten hands. And in trees that grow gigantic in crumbling courtyards leap little apes, while in and out of deep treasure vaults writhe poisoned serpents and scaly things without a name. Vast are the stones which sleep beneath coverlets of dank moss, and mighty were the walls from which they fell. For all time did their builders erect them, and in sooth they yet serve nobly, for beneath them the grey toad makes his habitation. At the very bottom of the valley lies the river Than, whose waters are slimy and filled with reeds. From hidden springs it rises, and to subterranean grottos it flows, so that the demon of the valley knows not why its waters are red, nor whither they are bound. The genie that haunts the moonbeams spake to the demon of the valley, saying,
I am old, and forget much. Tell me the deeds, and aspect, and name of them who built these things of stone.
And the demon replied,
I am memory, and I am wise and lore of the past, but I too am old. These beings were like the waters of the river Than, not to be understood. Their deeds I recall not, for they were but of the moment. Their aspect I recall dimly, it was like that of the little apes in the trees. Their name I recall clearly, for it rhymed with that of the river. These beings of yesterday were called Man.
So the genie flew back to the thin-horned moon, and the demon looked intently at the little ape in a tree that grew in a crumbling courtyard.
Wow. It's hard to follow that, but I'm just going to have to try. Our final segment for today is an original story called The Thing in the Shadows, written by Andrew Duncan. Andrew has a MySpace page called Andrew Writes, and I'll link to that in the show notes. I write this account, sure that I will not live to see another sunrise, so others will be able to act on the horrors I have seen. I find it hard to believe that merely 1 month passed, I was travelling to what is to be my final resting place. I was one of many to be traumatised by the part I played in the Great War. My doctor advised me to travel to the place I had been happiest as a child. I disregarded his suggestion until I purchased a new handgun and realized why I had brought it. The happiest part of my childhood had undoubtedly been our holidays in the Scottish Highlands. I made the arrangements and was sitting on the train before the end of the week. The air was crisp and fresh as I disembarked from the train, and although the town had changed, much was familiar. The guest house that I had arranged was perfect. The tiny cottage sat nestled at the bottom of a country road. The only other guest was an interesting young man named Robert Taylor, who had a passion for archaeology. I spent the first days of my stay exploring the nearby area and returning in the evening to discuss history and archaeology with my young friend. He was willing for me to help him on his excavations in the area. This was exactly what I needed at the time, and gladly I assisted him. I wish that I had never met the damnable man, but my regrets are meaningless now. The first day I did little more than carry his equipment and write notes, but it became clear to him that I was capable, and he allowed me to assist. The second site that we worked on together was the large untilled field behind the guest house. It yielded items of such bizarre nature that looking at them was enough to churn our stomachs. We discovered fragments of statues that seemed to depict dragons and squid. Robert was adamant that they were clearly mixed pieces, but I was sure that once they had been a single monstrous creature. We worked long into the evening, an unspoken compulsion to unearth the truth about these artifacts. Eventually the oncoming dark of night halted our efforts, and we retired to the bright warmth of the house. The landlady was leaving the kitchen as we came inside. She saw the fragments that we had recovered, and let out a shriek before crossing herself. She wobbled on her feet before beginning to tip backward. I rushed across the hallway and caught her before she hit the floor. She awoke moments later, her eyes fluttering open, and looked across at Robert, still holding the statue remains. "I'll not be having any of that in my house." Both Robert and I attempted to get her to elaborate on her dislike of the artifacts, but she was unwilling to discuss the foul taint we had introduced into her home. Robert became more exasperated with our host's refusal to talk and retired for the night. I expressed my apologies for upsetting her and said that I would also go to my room for the night. It wasn't until I was lying on my bed that I realized how deeply the artifacts had unsettled me. I was kept awake by inhuman sounds from the fields, and was sure that I saw some shapeless beast at my window that scratched at the glass. I was exhausted from the day's work, and eventually fatigue overwhelmed by terror. I awoke to the sound of rain beating on the roof, and sunlight streaming through the window highlighted a sight that made me sure that I was still dreaming. 3 diagonal scratches running across the window pane. I was shaken, and after I dressed, I looked in the mirror to see that I appeared pale and sickly. Mrs. Gardiner was busy cooking breakfast when I walked in. A gasp escaped her mouth when she turned to look at me. I waited until she had regained her composure before asking where Robert was. "Mr. Taylor has travelled into town to ask about those horrible sculptures at the museum." I spent the morning examining the marks on my window and checking for rational causes. The scratches were deep, and the rain had washed away any tracks that might have given a clue to the cause. I waited until after lunch, and there was still no sign of Robert returning. I decided to take a stroll across the fields and look for locations for further excavation. The walk was invigorating after working over the past 3 days, and I walked further than I had intended. The night was approaching, and with it the rain. I turned and began to walk back to the guest house. I still don't know if the feelings I had on that walk, of being followed and watched, were real or mere fragments of my imagination. But now, with my knowledge of what was to come, I believe them to have been real. I was aware of bizarre, unnatural shapes flying through the treetops and keeping pace with me. The hideous beasts, surely the same as the one at my window, never attempted to attack me, but I became aware that I was being followed by a man. I swallowed my fear and turned to face the man. He was still far off, and in the dark, I could not make out his features. I could see no point in confronting him, and hurried towards the safety of the house. I shut the door and leaned against the old oak panelling. Mrs. Gardiner came through from the sitting room, a look of concern on her face. "Are you all right, sir? You look a little flushed." I didn't want to go into the details of my unbelievable encounter, and explained my state as being due to the bracing night air. Robert was sitting at the dining table, dusty volumes piled high on the floor around him. He beckoned me over, and after I navigated through the stacks of books, he showed me what he had discovered. We pored over the books for much of the night, and when I eventually left for bed, Robert was still flicking through the pages of book after book. I was plagued by visions of those half-seen creatures. More than once I was sure I could see glowing red eyes haunting me from the fields. I laid awake for over an hour. The unnatural howls of my tormentors made sleep impossible. I fetched a handgun from my bag, and that made me feel a little safer. They continued to taunt me, and that night I didn't sleep. I fell asleep a little after dawn. The daylight drove the creatures away, and exhaustion claimed me. I awoke before noon and made my way into the sitting room. The books had been cleared away, and according to Mrs. Gardner, Robert had worked through the night and was now returning the books. I spent the remainder of the day using the map of the local area that I purchased before I left, marking areas which are considered viable for excavation. Robert did not return until it was almost dark. I showed him the locations I had marked on the map, but he showed little interest. "We should go straight to the main site. This could be the greatest archaeological discovery the world has ever known." He picked up the pencil and marked a cross deep within the forest to the east. I was prepared for another night battling with my fears of the monsters in the dark, but hadn't anticipated my sheer fatigue. The following morning I was disappointed to hear from Robert that he wanted to investigate this lead in the forest alone. I decided to explore the area alone, as I had before I began working with Robert. This became the pattern for the rest of the week. Robert would leave each morning, often before breakfast, and return later each night. I still discussed the sites with him, but he became introverted regarding the new dig, and eventually days went by when I hardly saw him. I was therefore surprised when Mrs. Gardner handed me a note after breakfast. The folded paper was covered in Robert's hasty script. He had made a world-changing discovery, and now he needed my help. The note also contained a torn piece of my map. I was confident that I would be able to find the area that he had marked. I had walked some of the public paths in the wood, but had never journeyed into the deeper wood. The thick wood was still easy to navigate, thanks to what I assumed to be Robert's recent track. I could hear the flapping of meaty wings in the treetops, and was glad to have the security of my pistol. The wood appeared to lose much of the green vitality, and the trees were rotten and dead. The branches didn't bend and spring back as they had nearer the edge of the forest, but broke from the trunk and dropped to the dark mud underfoot. I felt a chill in temperature and saw movement through the trees. The clearing ahead was filled with people. They wore robes and spoke bizarre guttural phrases. I couldn't hope to understand or record their phrases here. They conformed to no language I knew, and I could only pick out occasional words that I recognized from Robert's reference material. I felt certain that it was one of these cultists that had followed me to the guest house so many nights ago. I sat waiting in the undergrowth until they had finished their peculiar ritual and left. I began to make my way into the clearing, when I saw Robert come running towards me. They were a strange bunch, weren't they? I couldn't believe where he had just walked over from. A colossal stone entranceway stood half buried in the small hill. Robert laughed. "It does take your breath away when you first see it, doesn't it?" The arch was made of green stone and was covered with intricate carvings, similar to those of the fragments of sculpture which had started this mess. The next and final part of my story is the most important, and so, although painful to remember, I will provide as full of account as I dare. We entered the structure, which I assumed to be a temple of some kind. Robert led me from astonishing frieze to remarkable statue, like an overexcited schoolchild. I asked him if he felt the same sense of wrongness about the temple as I did, but he was too enthralled by the wonders he was discovering. We continued to delve deeper into the temple, and I became increasingly aware of savage shapes moving beyond the glow of our lights and sickening noises echoing through the chambers. The dark, dank passage seemed to continue forever, and I wondered how much soil and rock separated us from the warming sunlight. We reached an abrupt end in the passage. Careful examination revealed that the heavy stone was not a wall, but a gargantuan door. It was a supreme effort, but working together we forced the door open, although I wished we had not. The chamber beyond was the most disturbing place I have ever been, far more horrific than the Somme or the German gas attacks that had broken my mind and driven me to this place. The cavern was domed like a cathedral, the walls caked in some kind of luminescent fungus. I became aware that something was moving in the darkness in the centre of the chamber. The noise was almost deafening, and the stench of rotting fish filled the air. Robert moved from the doorway and began to examine the writing scrawled on the stone of the floor. I followed him, hoping to use my knowledge of languages to cast some light on their mystery. I had barely made it halfway to him, when a huge hand shot out from the darkness and grabbed Robert by his legs. The hand was tipped with equally massive claws, and as it began to pull Robert into the dark, a booming, terrible voice resonated in my mind. The voice spoke in the same language as the cultists outside, and many of the words were similar. I grabbed hold of Robert's arms and held on with all the strength I could muster. I stared into his eyes, terror clearly showing on his face. The power of the horrific shadow-cloaked monster began to drag us both across the floor. I grabbed the podium that we were passing and wrapped my legs around it. I could hear the pitiful sobs from Robert as his sweat-slicked palms began to slide from mine, and then, God help me, I let go. I watched as his panic-stricken face disappeared into the shadows. I will hear the screams long after my pitiful existence is forgotten. I ran from the chamber and back into the faintly glowing twilight, always sure that something would grab me and subject me to the same fate as my inquisitive friend. I charged through the wood, convinced that I would never find my way from the grip of the grim dead branches. I found myself back in the safe familiarity of the guest house, to find it dark and empty. I hoped that no misfortune had come to my host, but was soon preoccupied by the sounds of leathery wings beating outside the windows, and the sound of claws tapping on the roof. I can see no way out of this house alive, and so I beg of you, whoever finds this, the darkness in the forest must be silenced, and I will not allow those foul creatures the satisfaction of taking me. My pistol will finally serve the purpose it was purchased for. And that's all for today, except to say that if you have a creepy or scary story set in or around the 1920s, or a story set in any time period that includes elements of the Cthulhu mythos, please get in touch and perhaps we can get it on the show. Thanks for listening. Until next time. CthulhuPodcast.co.uk